The third case on this morning's call is number 032413, the United States against Darnell Murray.
May it please the court, my name is Colin McNary. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Chicago under the supervision of Abner Mikva. I will be arguing on behalf of Darnell Murray today pursuant to local circuit rule 34H. Today I'd like to focus on summary evidence in this case, on the admission of exhibits 222 and 223 and the jury instruction thereto. These exhibits are located in appendixes 1 and 2 to the appellant brief. Exhibits 222 and 223 were admitted pursuant to Rule 1006 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. There is no indication in the record whatsoever that the underlying records for these exhibits were made available to the defendant. The jury instruction that was given regarding these exhibits...
Weren't these virtually stipulated to, though? No objection made to them.
There was no objection made to them, but the fact that...
In fact, he specifically said, I have no objection.
Indeed, he said he had no objection. We contend that the fact that he mentioned out loud that he has no objection is no different from the forfeiture in him not objecting to begin with. In this circuit, in order for an evidentiary issue to be waived, there has to be more than just a statement that there is no objection. The only case cited by the government in their brief for an evidentiary waiver involved a situation where a motion in limine was put forward regarding an issue. The motion in limine was withdrawn, and then the defense counsel argued regarding that evidence during trial, and then tried to argue on appeal that it should not have been admitted.
Forgive me, but let me explain my problem. You seem to be asking us to decide a factual dispute about the government's behavior at trial when there seems to be no record evidence. In other words, you didn't represent Murray at trial. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if trial counsel asked the government to comply with 1006 or if the government complied with 1006 by producing the underlying documents for review. Mm-hmm. Can you help me with that?
Yes. There's no reason for us to contend that the government acted in bad faith and did not attempt to fulfill its obligations. What we're trying to point out is that there's no indication in the trial record whatsoever that the foundational requirements for 1006 evidence were met. There's no way of knowing whether or not these conditions were met. And because 1006 requires more than just passive availability of the underlying documents, that there is a requirement that goes above and beyond discovery requirements, that the absence of any indication in the record is an error in and of itself. And this error is compounded by the fact that this evidence in which the rules were not followed to a T was then told to the jury to be true and accurate, so that the jury credited this evidence as being extremely persuasive.
Do we know what parts of the summary charts are inaccurate?
We do not know if any of the parts of the summary charts are inaccurate. There's no evidence in the record about whether or not they're accurate. The only thing in the record is that in regards to the stipulation issue that was brought up earlier, was that on cross-examination, the defense counsel did try to raise issues about whether or not the preparer of the chart had done a good job in summarizing the underlying record. But again, there's no evidence in the record that they're inaccurate. But the idea being is that the reason for the make availability requirement in 1006 is because we want to shift the burden of showing inaccuracies to the defense counsel. And when we do not know if the records have been made available, then that burden shifting does not occur particularly well. And this is why that in the First Circuit in Air Safety and the Sixth Circuit in Modena enforce passive availability of underlying records, because they want to make it a bit easier for the defense counsel to fulfill its burden to make sure that these records are available. And this is all motivated, of course, by how important summary evidence is at trial, because it has been recognized by many circuits and by the Supreme Court as being unusually powerful and persuasive.
Well, we'd have a different situation if the defense counsel had not said no objection.
No, I don't believe we would. The fact of the matter is that his no objection in this case at that point was merely the articulation of his inability to think of an objection at that time. And it seems to be especially important that we...
Well, now, we don't know that. I mean, the inference could be just as well that he'd already seen the background material and he didn't have any objection.
This is true. We do not have any reason necessarily to believe that. But the reason I put forward that these situations are indistinguishable is because this circuit, when it looks to waiver cases, does not is sensitive to the rights that are being waived. And in this case, we have a piece of evidence that was instructed to be true and accurate that will sustain guilt on its own. And for the defense counsel to waive any objections to that merely by saying that he has no objections does not fit with the rule.
How would you have handled it, for example, if he had seen the background material and it didn't conflict with the summary? What would you say?
If he had seen it?
Yeah. If you put yourself in the position of the defense counsel in that scenario, that he had seen the background material that supported the summary evidence, what would you say?
I think...
When it's offered.
When it's offered. If he had not had the opportunity to
accept my premise, he'd seen it, it matched, and they were offering it, what would you say?
A defense counsel at that point would have to say that there is no objection to this material because he had evaluated the underlying records. But in the circumstances, again,
he might just shorthand say no objection.
He might say that, yes. But again, the thing that we're trying to point to is not just the absence of objection by the defense counsel in this case, but the fact that the government has a burden when they're putting evidence into the record at trial to lay the foundational elements for it. And the make availability requirement, again, is not
in other words, in part of their offer of the evidence, they should have said this has been, the background material has been provided to counsel.
Yes.
Well, isn't it clear, though, that there is not currently an obligation in this circuit for the government to inform the district court on the record that the underlying documents were previously produced before a summary chart is admitted? And given that there's no obligation to do this, it can hardly be plain error that a court didn't require the government to do so here, can it?
Mm-hmm. I think there's two important things to look at in this situation. The first is that when identifying the plain error, this can't be divorced from the context of the jury instruction, that we do have a piece of evidence here that has been given to the jury and told to be true. And so any error in the admission of that evidence, any sense of that being a little bit unreliable, is going to be magnified by the fact that the jury has been told by the judge to trust this to a large degree.
Yeah, but the court did ask defense counsel if he had any objection to the summary chart, both at trial and at and at the sentencing hearing, and both times he stated he had no objection. And he at the sentencing, defense counsel indicated he would have no basis for an objection. So, to the admissibility of the summary charts. So that indicates that counsel felt there was no good faith basis to object. And that not only would indicate a waiver, it would indicate that, or certainly suggest, that he reviewed the underlying documents and knew that the charts were accurate summaries.
I think that there are many ways that we could characterize what the meaning of saying basis as opposed to saying no objection are. I think you could easily agree that no basis means I have no thought in my head about how I might object to this, rather than I have reviewed entirely the law in this area and I can conceive of no possible way of objecting. And I think the thing that's important to note is that in terms of whether or not that comment itself becomes a waiver is that in this circuit, waiver has been interpreted liberally. And even in the case of United States, in this circuit, there was previously, we have in situations where a defendant did not bring up a self-defense claim at trial and then brought it up for the first time on direct appeal. this court said that that had not been waived because the defendant had not knowingly relinquished that right at trial. And this is, again, a similar situation. We have a very important right, and we don't have any indication that it was knowingly relinquished. All we have is a somewhat ambiguous statement that's most likely interpreted as meaning that the defense counsel just doesn't know if there's an objection there.
This was a federal defender representing the defendant?
This was someone in the federal defender pool. And so this case is not a situation where we can have a waiver. We could have a waiver if it had been explicit and if there had been knowingness. But again, there's no knowing and intelligent waiver of the right in this case. And it's especially, again, I mean, I need to stress how important it is that the introduction of this evidence occurred in a situation where the judge instructed the jury that the evidence was true and accurate. And that fact of the matter is that once the jury saw the summary chart, which alleged crimes sufficient to sustain count two, and were told that they were true and accurate, there's no way that this jury could not find Mr. Murray guilty. It's just, we can say that it had a substantial effect, but we know there could be no other verdict. And this is a very, very serious error. And even though it's somewhat difficult to get around the waiver issue, we have to say that the fact of the matter is that the judge letting in this evidence without ensuring the reliability and then telling the jury that it's true, and then that evidence being sufficient to convict the defendant, must be plain error.
The government's conceded, moving to another area, that there is a problem with the restitution order in this thing. What's your feeling about that? What should we do?
We welcome that the government has given up the claims for restitution for the conduct charged before the indictment. But we also believe that there is the difference between our position and the government's position is in how they interpret specific conduct on of the offense of conviction versus how we interpret it. And this is a special area in the sense in that the previous precedent in this case, Randall, dealt with a crime where each specific act was a charge in and of itself. And whereas in this case, we have an open-ended crime under 18 U.S.C. 1029A2, where many, many specific acts can be included under a charge. So conceivably, under the government's opinion, what we could have is a situation where you could charge someone with an open-ended crime, you could prove maybe five or six acts, and then at sentencing, you could order them to pay restitution for 100 acts that might be included in that. And if you were to take the hypothetical even farther, you could say something to the effect of, you could define criminal acts in such a way that they would be open-ended. So any violent crime occurring, one or more violent acts occurring within a 10-year period would be a particular crime, and then you could include any crime you wanted in that.
Well, if we were to send this back for resentencing with regard to restitution, how would you ask us to instruct the district court to look at it?
I would ask you to instruct the district court to say that restitution should be based on the conduct demonstrated at trial and shown at trial, because the specific conduct that is the basis of the conviction should be the specific conduct that led to the conviction, rather than any kind of conduct that can linguistically be fit into the conduct that was charged at trial, so that only acts where there was evidence in the record should be proven at trial. And that's what happened in Randall. The only distinction between this case and Randall is the fact that we have an open-ended type of charge. With that, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Neary.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Barnes.
May it please the court. The defendant did waive any objections to the exhibits and the jury instruction at trial.
Mr. Barth, can you clear something up right off the bat? Did the defendant have access to the records underlying the summary charts or not?
Not in the record, but the answer is yes. In the defendant's brief, in his footnote number 8, he refers to a letter that was produced in discovery 2 months before the trial that not only did it make the records available, most of the records were copied, but it gave him the summary chart. The summary chart he had itself 2 months in advance. And I don't think that's the objection. He's not claiming the summary chart was inaccurate. He's not claiming that the records weren't produced. He's saying the trial record was silent. First, I disagree with that. There were four indications that I found in the record. First, Before the summary chart was even admitted, there was a stipulation that referred to it. We started the trial. I was one of the trial lawyers. We started the trial by calling the victims, people that got up there and said, I didn't make these charges. I don't know that man. I didn't authorize him to make charges on my account. After two of those victims, the defense attorney reached a stipulation with the government where we said, okay, we're not going to parade in the rest of the victims here. He'll stipulate that the rest of the victims, as listed on Kelly Meter's summary charts, the charts that we were going to offer, would testify the same, that they didn't make those purchases, they didn't authorize the defendant to make those purchases. So he knew exactly what he was doing. Everybody knew, the jury knew, the district court knew, the defense attorney knew that those summary charts...
I'm sorry, this came in as part of the evidence in the case. These witnesses were before the jury, then the stipulation came in, we're not going to have any...
Yes, we're not going to call any more of them. You're going to see a summary chart, and we're stipulating that. That's on page 4 of my brief. I referred to that. So when the summary chart came in, the district court knew they were coming, the jury knew they were coming, the defense attorney knew they were coming. When we offered it in, the defense attorney said, I have no objection. That's the second indication. The third indication, we offered the pattern jury instruction on summary charts that say that they are true and accurate, that the information on the charts truly and accurately comes from the underlying documents. He said no objection to that instruction. He agreed with the instruction. The fourth indication at sentencing, when he's asked yet again by the district court, he says, I have no basis for an objection. The summaries are the documents. So, as I think this court said in Richardson, and I'm paraphrasing, what more could the district court do? It's one thing to require the district court to be alert when a party might sleep on their rights, but it's entirely another thing for the district court to overrule the express intention of a party. And that's why there was such a clear waiver in this case of the issue he's raised on appeal. However, I think this case does provide an opportunity for this court to comment on what ought to be the procedure with Rule 1006 summaries. There's no doubt that the underlying records have to be made available. That's in the Federal Rule of Evidence itself, and that's what all the appellant's cases say. What none of those cases say is whether or not the proponent of that evidence has to somehow make that part of the trial record. We think that it was part of the trial record when he says no objection, but even so, we disagree with his suggestion in his brief that we should somehow... there should be some requirement that we file some paper with the district court. There's no reason to paper the district courts with this issue. These are things that are typically handled by counsel in letters, the fore court, as it was in this case, as it is with Rule 404B, which has a notice requirement. Rule 16 of Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure provides that for defendant statements, expert testimony, you're to give notice of those things. And there's no requirement that you file that with the court and paper the district court, confirming your compliance. You let the parties know when the evidence comes in at trial, the other party stands up and says, wait a minute, we had no notice that they were going to call this expert. We had no notice they were going to use the summary chart. We had no notice of this defendant's statement. And then the burden is then on the proponents of the evidence to say, to demonstrate their compliance with the rule.
Well, it wouldn't be too burdensome, though, to say as a part of your offer of the evidence to say we provided the background material of this chart to the opposing counsel. That's not too burdensome.
It wouldn't be too burdensome, but it's certainly, as Her Honor pointed out, it's never been a requirement here or anywhere else with regard to Rule 1006 summaries, 404B evidence, or any of the other materials I listed. But I also don't think that it's too burdensome to leave it to the other side to simply voice an objection, hey, we've never seen this before. And I think in practice that's how it's been done.
You know, the defendant claims that there are some errors in your brief. For example, that Exhibits 40 and 47 were never admitted into evidence. Can you clear up?
When I read his reply brief, I tried to pull the record back, but the record was already checked out. It's my belief that on those are referring now to the fingerprint exhibits. The copies of the fingerprints were put in through the business record custodians, and then the fingerprint expert came in and looked at the originals, of course, which you would have to do to find the fingerprints on them. It's my belief that Exhibits 40 and 47 were admitted either through the records custodian or through Rosalba Vila. She was the store employee who actually was there when the defendant filled out those documents. And without looking back at the record, basically what he did was he came in, he filled out a a form that added himself to the account of Gerald Murphy, an individual who testified at trial, and provided a copy of his driver's license. She photographed those materials, and they made it into the file. She may have actually put in the original exhibit on those two. She may have laid the foundation to put in the originals on those two. But between the originals and those copies, I'm certain that Rosalba Vila or the underlying records custodian did put those in. And as a backdrop to all this, we of course argued that there was no plain error because the result would have been the same. The evidence in this case, I'm sure it's a phrase that's overused, but it truly was overwhelming. There was videotape played that showed the defendant making a purchase on someone else's account. His cousin testified against him at the multiple purchases they made together. There was recorded conversations. There was just a huge paper trail that I've set forth. Let me turn now.
Before you do, let me just go back to something that you asked us to do. You know, the Ninth Circuit seems to have a requirement that is part of the foundation for admission, the proponent of a summary charge has to establish that the underlying documents were made available, right? Well, take my word for it. Would we have to split from the Ninth Circuit to find no such requirement here? That's the Paddock case.
There's no doubt that the proponent bears the ultimate burden of proving compliance with the rule. The question is whether they have to do that in every case as a matter of course, to say before we get to this judge, call a sidebar or something and say, you know, by the way, we did make these underlying records available. I don't believe there is such a requirement. And if it is in the Ninth Circuit, I'm not familiar with that case. I'm not sure there is such a requirement in any court. Every court says that the proponent bears the burden.
You go back and you read this case, okay? 745 F. 2nd, 1254, 9th Circuit, 1984. It's Paddock versus Dave Christensen. Then you'll be sure.
Okay. Well, I certainly don't doubt, Your Honor. But the point is, there's no doubt that if he raises the issue, then we would bear the burden of proving.
Our concern is whether or not you gave it to him. And you've indicated, I mean,
it's not in the record. I've indicated that they cite in their brief the letter, which right. turned over the summary chart itself. Secondly, I can tell you that...
And you responded to Judge Rovner's questions that you did provide.
And all indications, yes, and all indications in the record are consistent with that by his no objection to the charts and the jury instruction and his stipulation that related to the chart. And certainly...
And a typical way for that to be raised is if there was an objection because you didn't follow.
Yes, and then we would bear the burden of proving our compliance. Turning to restitution, we have agreed to conceded that there should be a limited modification of the restitution order. In this case, the indictment charged that between April and October, the defendant used these unauthorized access devices to aggregate over $1,000. At trial, there was $240,000 put in between that period. At sentencing, there was $650,000 put in that extended that period back from December of 01 to October of 02. We have said cut out the part from December of 01 to April of 02 that was beyond the period charged in the indictment. Everything else should stay.
What's the matter with the suggestion by counsel for the defendant that you just include that evidence you put in at trial?
Well, I don't think there's any such requirement or any cases that say that it's limited to that. We've cited a First Circuit case where they said that you could rely upon suppressed evidence. There's an Eighth Circuit case.
No case yet.
Well, we cited some authorities for the point that you're not limited to trial evidence, a First Circuit case and an Eighth Circuit case that was remanded on other grounds. But certainly the charge here covered this period, April to October, and the fact that we limited our evidence to simply $240,000 as opposed to overkilling it with the $570,000 that occurred in that period doesn't prevent us. It's the same victim of the offense, G Capital, and it's the same offense of conviction that he was ordered to pay restitution for. And that's why we think that even a remand is perhaps not necessary. We could simply modify it by reducing it by the $88,888.11. It's strictly a math calculation.
The time frame you're talking about is included within the indictment. Those
yes.
And that evidence would be that you presented at trial in that sense.
Yes, the district court found credible in rendering her finding both as to the offense level, which they don't appeal, and as to the restitution amount. So for all those reasons, we would ask that this court affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant and modify selectively the restitution order.
Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Your Honor.
One minute, 30 seconds.
Thank you. I'd first like to address the issue brought up about the letter that was contained in the brief. Now, this letter states that there's an intent, to summarize voluminous documents, which implies Rule 1006, but there's no statement that it is Rule 1006 that it's going to be brought into it. And the letter itself includes a chart that was not the chart that was brought at a trial. During discovery materials, there's a great deal of variations on different charts that come up in different forms. And the thing that was presented with that letter is not the chart that you have in the appendixes. Secondly, I wanted to get to the issue of the stipulation. The stipulation does not stipulate anything relating to guilt. All it stipulates to is the certain facts in the chart. If you look at the charts themselves, the only things that attach to guilt are the fact that Mr. Murray's name or an alias is in a secondary user column and the phone number that was used to access that call. Those pieces of data were not stipulated to. The only thing that was stipulated to was that these transactions occurred, that the people didn't know Mr. Murray, they didn't authorize him to make any transactions, but it said nothing about whether or not Mr. Murray participated in those transactions or had access to those accounts. Another thing that was brought up during the government's presentation was Exhibits 40 and 47. And what 40 and 47 were clean copies of Exhibits 212 and 214, because those exhibits were damaged during,
Please continue your thought.
Were damaged during the fingerprinting process. And so they were in the book of exhibits to be presented, but they were in fact never introduced at trial. And there was no business records that were introduced under the testimony of Mr. Juan Anzar. And because the summary evidence is so persuasive and this jury instruction is so incorrect and so wrong, we ask for reversal in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McNary. Mr. McNary, you also serve by appointment of the court. Please accept our sincere thanks and congratulations on a job very well done. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.